The truth will set you free, but not until it's done with you. The first time I heard those words, they rang in my head like a bell. There was something liberating about them. Deception, denial, and delusion are traps that limit life, that constrain and demean it. The truth will set you free. I've experienced this firsthand and witnessed it in the lives of people around me. It's the story of the alcoholic who finally faces the fact of her addiction and begins the long road to recovery. It's the story of the person who realizes that he's gay, who begins the process of coming out to himself and his family, who learns how to navigate a whole new world of dating and relationship. The truth will set you free, but not until it's done with you. It takes time. The road between facing the truth and experiencing freedom is sometimes long, sometimes dangerous, and often difficult. But the goal is worth the journey, however hard it may be. The first step can be challenging, even when the truth is right in front of us, staring us in the face. And it begins when we crack the edifice of our own denial and deception. I love the story when Harry Met Sally, especially the character of Sally's best friend Jess, who was played with brilliant comedic timing by Carrie Fisher. Jess is in a relationship with a married man and has been for some years. It is not going well, for lots of good reasons. One afternoon, she sits down to lunch with Sally and another friend named Alice. She confesses that she has rummaged through her boyfriend's pockets and has turned up a receipt. The boyfriend and his wife have just purchased a dining room table for $1,600, which is a lot of money now and was a lot more money in 1980-whatever. Jess leans in and she throws her hands in the air and exclaims, with an air of disbelief, "He is never going to leave her." The two friends don't react much. Alice says, "You've known that for 2 years. What's new?" Caught off guard, Jess slumps. "You're right, you're right. I know you're right." The conversation moves on, but it's repeated another couple of times during the course of the movie. Jess reveals that she's engaged in some new form of espionage and has come to the conclusion that her boyfriend is going to remain in his marriage. But she doesn't change what she's doing. She doesn't leave him. I love this scene because it rings true. I know that many of the truths that I have had trouble seeing in my own life have been pretty obvious to people around me. Truth about past boyfriends or past possible choices of a major in college. The problem wasn't that the truth at hand was hard to see. The problem was that I didn't like the reality that was in front of me, and I was waiting for a more palatable alternative. About an hour into the film, Jess meets someone new, and she's able to move on. The deeper truth of her story was that she was just afraid to be alone. All summer long, we'll be preaching about the spiritual arts of democracy, the spiritual demands of democracy, and this week is a kind of trifecta in honor of the 4th of July: truth, freedom, and reckoning. There's a truth about our nation we need to grapple with. There has always been an underclass in America, with little or no access to the rights and privileges of our democracy. That has been true from the start, exemplified most starkly by the genocide of American Indians and the enslavement of Africans. And until we deal with that fact, we will never come into our promise as a nation. Many years ago, I met a man in the streets of Cambridge. He was a black man, homeless. He asked me for money, and then he asked me a question about God. We talked for about 15 or 20 minutes in the fading light. We talked about religion and democracy and personhood. And near the end of our conversation, he broke down crying. He said, "They said we were 3/5 of a man," and he stood on that street and he wept. I understood him. On a literal level, he was referring to the Constitution. When it was drafted, there was deep division between representatives of the northern and southern states. They had agreed that congressional representation would be based on a state's population, but they disagreed about how to count slaves. In the end, they compromised. Slaves would be counted as 3/5 of a person for the purpose of determining representation for white citizens. The deal occurred in 1789, but its legacy was powerful enough to reduce a grown man to tears in 1999. The history of our early days was still alive in his experience as a black man. It is still alive in my own experience of American citizenship as a black woman. Our national story is a liberation tale, but we are not quite there yet. In 1776, Thomas Jefferson wrote the Declaration of Independence with these soaring words: "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal and are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness." Our founding documents were constructed to elevate the ideals of equality and to institutionalize inequality. This inequality was grounded in a sense of entitlement to free labor and newly discovered lands. It was justified by racial prejudice and perceived economic necessity. There has always been a gulf between the reality of America and the fantasy. It's time to face the truth that racism and economic exploitation are still part of the fabric of American society. It's time for reckoning and repair. It's time for real freedom that extends to all our citizens and those non-citizens on whom our way of life depends. There's risk in facing the truth, but there's also potential. The point of raising difficult truths is not to lay blame, but to get free. I wrestled, to be honest, about how to talk about this subject, how plainly to speak about my perspectives. And then I saw the flags. I was on my way to Milford, New Hampshire this week to officiate at the wedding of a very sweet couple. I was most of the way there when I saw a truck coming toward me in the opposite lane with an enormous American flag rippling at the back corner. You've heard me tell this story before, but it's not that story. It's a new story. It's the same story. I could see another flag blowing in the wind on the other corner of the truck, and it was not, as I hoped, a Marine Corps flag, but a large Confederate flag. And here's the thing. It should not make sense for these two flags to be on the same truck. The Confederate and Union flags were the standards of people on opposite sides of a war. The only meaning that I can read into those symbols displayed together proudly in the days leading up to the 4th of July is a message of white supremacy, a reaffirmation of the principle that there are two classes of Americans and that the country belongs first and foremost to its white citizens. The underclass on which America depends for prosperity does not consist entirely of people of color or even American citizens. It includes non-citizen workers who are easily exploited as cheap laborers. It includes low-income white folks who some people call trash. People are never trash. No person is expendable. I cringe every time I hear an ostensibly progressive person speak this way. We as a nation can muster the courage to look at our past and present and reimagine ourselves. I am hopeful. I think in part because I am black. I am hopeful, not because I am blind to the devastations of our history, but I have seen what can be done despite the devastations of our history. I have faith in the promise of our democracy. I believe in it, and I will work every day of my life on behalf of this democracy. I watched a beautiful film the other day about James Baldwin called I Am Not Your Negro. The film is based on his notes for a book he never completed in which he explored his relationships to three men he revered: Medgar Evers, Malcolm X, and Martin Luther King. Baldwin points out that Malcolm X and Dr. King started out almost as polar opposites, but that by the time of their deaths, their perspectives about race and economics were very similar. Both had broadened the scope of their critique and activism to embrace questions of economics and class. Both understood racism and economic injustice to be deeply intertwined issues. James Baldwin was startlingly direct when he spoke about race in America. In 1965, he offered up a searing indictment of our society. It includes a racial epithet that I cannot repeat from the pulpit. I will say Negro instead, but you'll understand my meaning. He said, "What white people have to do is to try to find out in their hearts why it was necessary for them to have a Negro in the first place. Because I am not a Negro. I am a man. If I'm not the Negro here, and if you invented him, then you have to find out why. And the future of the country depends on that, whether or not it is able to ask that question." When I was a child, I had a set of nesting wooden Russian dolls. You could open it up and there'd be an identical smaller doll inside. There were maybe 6 in total, 1 tucked inside another. Our progress as a nation has been a lot like these dolls. We abolished slavery. And then we created Jim Crow, a social political structure that reestablished the social stratification of the slave era. We stuck down Jim Crow. But those values remained alive in public policy and in social mores around housing and policing and education and even environmental protections. We need to get to the root of the problem and stop creating minifigures that mimic the worst of American history. We need to imagine something entirely new that has not ever been. We can acknowledge the far-reaching effects of how we began and the ways our beginning still defines us. The truth will set us free. It will be a hard road. But the site of our deepest national shames, our largest moral failures, is also the most fertile ground for the birth of real recovery, redemption, and freedom. It has been this way throughout our nation's history, in the quest for civil liberties of all kinds, in the struggle for fair compensation and safe conditions for American workers, in the movement to empower women and girls. We face the hard truths of where we are so that we can chart a course to where we hope to be. In 1963, James Baldwin and a number of other black and white cultural leaders met with Attorney General Bobby Kennedy. Playwright Lorraine Hansberry was in the room. The meeting was, by all accounts, a disaster. At the time, protesters were being brutally beaten in Birmingham. There were pictures in all the papers of peaceful, neatly dressed protesters in Alabama being attacked by dogs and armed men. The black people in the room were emotional and agitated and impatient. They demanded protection for peaceful demonstrations. They demanded a stronger defense of civil rights. They asked Bobby Kennedy to influence the president. They wanted President John Kennedy to accompany personally a young black woman into the all-white Alabama University she was scheduled to attend in just a few days' time. They said such an action would send a clear message. It would say that when angry mobs spat on that girl, they spat also on the nation. It would say that when a person degrades an American citizen, that person degrades our democracy. Bobby Kennedy brushed them off, saying the gesture would be empty and meaningless. But Lorraine Hansberry persisted. She looked the Attorney General in the eye and said, "We would like from you a moral commitment." She declared, "I am very worried about the state of a civilization which produced the photograph of a white cop standing on that Negro woman's neck in Birmingham." And then she smiled and she said goodbye and she walked out of the room. Kennedy left frustrated, convinced that black leaders were unreasonable and inflexible, but the meeting was a turning point in his approach to civil rights. In the months that followed, he encouraged President Kennedy to address the nation and introduce the legislation that would become the Civil Rights Act of 1964. These events took place a long time ago, but it feels like history is repeating itself. It is not easy to face what needs to be faced in our country. Racism and economic exploitation and the continued corruption of our democratic institutions by massive influxes of money. It is not easy. No one said it would be easy. No one said even that everyone would survive. History tells us that they won't. But I do say it is possible. It is possible to repair elements of our national infrastructure that have been broken from the start. It is possible to become the country we think we are, to become the country we ought to be, a nation of laws, a nation of citizens, in which all are free. The truth will set us free, but not until it's done with us. Amen.